You're listening to The God Journey, a place where people thinking outside the box of organized religion can share thoughts and conversation along the journey. Here are your hosts and fellow travelers, Wayne Jacobson and Brad Cummings.
All right, we're back for another podcast of The God Journey.
You sound so tired.
No, I think we have a meaty thing to deal with. We talked about George Barna and his book, The Revolution, and we're going to tackle just kind of a little bit of what's in there in this show. But, it's interesting because, you get someone like Barna, who is like the premier statistician.
I was going to say who he is, because I don't think everybody knows who George Barna is.
As Gallup would be to polling in the big picture of America, I think Barna is probably a close parallel to that within the world of Christendom, especially within America. And, I think he is referred to as the most often quoted person within the church world, because largely he's been the biggest researcher and statistician. And
he has. He's got a lot of press in Christianity Today over the years, and mostly his audience is pastors or church leaders. Mostly his audience. So most normal
folks, they don't know anything about him.
I do, George Martin, but he's very, very well known, and he's been doing statistics for years about how the institutional congregational environment is becoming increasingly irrelevant in our culture. That's kind of where he's been polling for 20 years and kind of citing those trends and offering ways to fix the box.
Yeah, he's been a little bit like a doctor trying to write prescriptions of, if this is the diagnosis of where we're really at, then, I think he's a good analytical thinker.
He's
really sharp on a lot of things. And I think he's always tried to bring forth, a God-inspired, as best he has understood, prescription for, here's what then must we do.
Here's the problem, here's how we can fix it institutionally.
Yeah.
But this book's a bit different.
Well, it's interesting. I can bring in a little personal reality. It's not like George and I are close friends, but I did bump into him 4 years ago when I was marrying a couple. He was sitting in the audience. And it was just sort of bizarre to be doing a little, it's not exactly a little veranda in Malibu, nice wedding, and all of a sudden, boom.
Well, you really touched the high class, Malibu. Mexican vacation.
Off to the French Riviera.
This is the God I want to serve right here.
It's a good journey, I tell you.
Tell you what.
But there, plunk, right in the midst of the deal, it's like, there's George Barna. And I just went, what an odd place to find him. Not as if he's not a person. It doesn't go.
He's
a normal person. But we had a really neat conversation following the service, over dinner. I'd gone up to him because I was curious, because I'd been noticing that the thickness of his books was getting thinner and thinner. And I asked a rather bizarre question to him. I said, George, you know what? I'm really curious, just as someone who has enjoyed a lot of what you've read. I said, your books are getting thinner and thinner. I said, why is that? And it was an honest question. It wasn't a poke at him. And he looked at me and he just said, you really want to know? And I said, yeah. I said, is it a marketing thing? He said, honest reality is, I'm not so sure what to think anymore. He said, the last book that I wrote was The Second Coming of the Church. And he said, if you ask me today where my thoughts are, he said, I don't think we're going to see the Second Coming of the Church. He says, I think the church is dead. And I'm struggling to figure out what to do, because all the research that I'm going through. And that was 4 years ago. And I did bump into him several different times on this journey, but I knew that he took his organization from 180 some employees down and stripped it down to just 9. And he's dismantled a lot of, quote, his machine. And he has gone off the radar. He wasn't in the last 4 years as public a figure as he was before. I had met him when he had a prescription for, he'd identified 2,000 of the most vibrant, healthy churches in America, and he had a plan and a program that he was really excited about implementing with them that was going to touch beyond the walls of the church into the culture. And honestly, at the time, I was excited along with him. I was like, wow, this is great, the research, the insights. And yet, it's interesting to finally come to this book, and he's on a much different plane.
And this book's causing a bit of a stir, quite frankly, between folks that kind of hoping that this is their institutional man. He's helping us build, they wouldn't say it this way, but I always saw it as helping us build a better mousetrap. And now he's just saying maybe the mousetrap's not worth keeping around.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. His associate, Tom Black, gave me a call maybe about 9 months ago. And while I was in Vail at the time, so I was
like, oh, great.
So I'm on a little ski trip. I haven't had a whole lot to do after
pastoring.
You
do sound like a TV preacher.
I do,
you know
yeah,
that?
Yeah. Goodness. Keep those donations coming.
Oh, man.
Ah, yeah, and the other job I do.
That's worse than what you said two podcasts
the
ago.
Other job I do to pay the bills is a landscaper, so give me a break.
Okay. There you go.
The reality is Tom called me, and he gave me sort of the lowdown where they're at and what they're thinking, and it's like they really felt like this was going to be a challenging missile shot over the bow of the institutional church, and they were struggling with the fact that they thought this was going to really produce big shock waves. And then, I don't know the ins and outs, but I imagine that their very publisher was probably, going like, you're about to shoot your own audience in the foot. You're going to blast them, offend them. I was like, and this was published by Barna.
Yeah, I knew their publisher didn't want to do it because he was attacking his core audience, which is not a great way to go. And basically, he's not giving up on local congregations, per se.
No, the predominant finding is that they had noticed statistically, research-wise, that there was a complete decline in the attendance of the church, and the fastest-growing segment of, quote, the body of Christ today were people who were no longer attached to a regular Sunday fellowship or identify that as, quote, their home, but they were outside of the organized institutional church. And I think the basic premise is they were first looking at that with a sense of alarm. What they've come back, having interviewed and taken a real look at, is the real reason for that is people's hunger for God. Their genuine passion for God has exceeded what they have found being offered within the confines of the institutional church. And so these people are outside because they are growing, they are excited about God, and they are finding that the local church in many respects is irrelevant to what's going on in the culture. And they're wanting to still do something about it.
Boy, you can imagine some people are not going to enjoy reading this book. I like the way he, in this, kind of redefines the nature of church life and saying we've had a culture that I don't know how many decades we've really defined church life as participation in one of these institutions we call churches who meet on Sunday, some occasionally, some on Saturday, but they meet once a week. They have all these programs that go on for their kids and for various ministries, and your participation in the church means you're locked into one of those. And that's been kind of the unaccepted, the accepted norm for some time.
Yeah, that validates that you are a Christian.
And he moves away from that in a quite obvious way. He's saying things like, sadly many people will label this blasphemy, but you should realize that the Bible neither describes nor promotes the local church as we know it today.
Yeah.
Now that's going to shake a lot of people's theology, ecclesiology if nothing else, because we've made the Christian life and attendance on Sunday morning synonymous.
Yeah.
And now a lot of us haven't. I mean, I've been out of that for 12 years. Others have been out of it far longer that are on this podcast. Some are coming much more recently. But I think this group describes a lot of the people that I travel and hang out with, people who've just, they didn't necessarily leave bitter, they didn't necessarily leave angry, but they just said, you know what? What I hunger for isn't there. And there's a lot of what is there is a lot of time and energy and money put to things that I don't consider ultimately fruitful in my spiritual life, nor in the culture I live in, to make God known. And so he identifies that as a pretty strong group of people. He's saying it's probably 30% now of those that make up Christians. He posits that if trends continue, 20 years from now, right now he's got 70% of committed Christians attend a Sunday morning event, 30% do not. He's saying in 20 years those statistics will flip-flop, and actually 30% will still be attending Sunday morning institutions, and there 30% will, and 70% will be living outside those walls. And he talks about a number of alternative, informal, some more formalized house church kinds of arrangements, but also informal fellowships and things that people are living by. So it's a pretty significant trend to identify that as a major block of the body of Christ in this nation. And pretty much he deals just with America. We're not talking about really dealing beyond that, though I've been traveling around the world enough to know that it is also true elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, he basically kind of writes it from a standpoint that says that, you know, what's going on is that in such an unprecedented reengineering of America's faith, this is likely to be the most significant transition in the religious landscape that you will ever experience. I mean, the tones in which he writes is he said what they're observing that's happening right now is on such a scale that in our lifetime we'll never see something so revolutionary. And I think that's the term that he totally fixates on, which, you know, I understand from a research.
Are we going to talk about the term? Because I would love to talk about the
term. Yeah, I do. I mean, because, you know, as I read through the book and having a context in which to know George a little bit, I'm excited with some of the conclusions, because he's always the guy that I sort of felt was the program guy. I mean, the last time I sat down meaningfully with him, he shared with me this whole prescription of what he was going to do. This was the plan, and I sort of went, wow, this is a significant departure from that. And so it seems like a lot of his approach to all this is changing, and yet I think this is probably just the mishap of, you know, trying to analyze and systematize something. But when he starts talking about the seven passions of a revolutionary and focuses so much on the word revolution, 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 I just found myself struggling with it, because I agreed with a lot of the things that he said, but when there was an overemphasis and a focus on the term revolution or the marks of a revolutionary, I just found myself having a little disconnect, going like, it is not about that.
Yeah, it really isn't. And when you talk about the revolution that's going on and the way people are thinking about God and the church, I'm really comfortable with that language.
Yeah.
When you talk about this is a revolution and we're going to call these people revolutionaries, now I've got some issues, because I don't think Martin Luther's band, you know, sat around and talked about, why don't we start a new revolution and we'll change the whole. I've heard so many things in my 40 years of being a believer of some awareness. I'm not older than 40, but at least the last 40 I've been aware of things going on. That we always call things, we always predict and speculate how something is going to be transforming, and it never, and everybody's always come, I mean, I remember a book came out, the self-esteem thing that I think Schuller did, this will be the next reformation of the church. Everybody's trying to say this is the next this, and we honestly don't know that. Those things you know by hindsight, you never know them by foresight. But I didn't like the term revolutionary, because it kind of sets in mind that those of us who are maybe outside those things are wanting to overthrow, the term of revolutionary is to overthrow something, is to work against something, and I don't find that passion. I do find among some who want to call the institutional congregations Babylon and, you know, leave her and tear her down. That's a very small group of house church folks who use that kind of rhetoric. I think most of us that I hang out with who found themselves outside of that for the time being, don't have a lot of angst about it. We're not angry about it. We don't want to destroy it. I sometimes go there and teach and know people who are part of places like that, but our passion is to live out something real in life in God, wherever that is. Man, I don't care if you're in a building, and I don't care if you're in your home, and I don't care. I just want God to be real and for you to connect with brothers and sisters in a way that makes sense in your journey.
I don't think it's possible for us to know the inner motives of a man. I mean, I don't even think, you know, Jesus kind of says that, you know, through Paul, we can't even know our own heart. So, you know, I don't want to be assessing George's motives. But I do think, in having talked with some of his associates, they do see this as a missile shot over the bow of the church. I mean, there is an agenda. He is unashamedly championing the revolution. He is seeking to, I think, to be a, you know, like sort of Uncle Sam, you know, wants you. This is George Barna on a map with the revolution, and he's pointing a finger. He wants you. He is calling people out. I mean, there's a direct. There's nice language at times that kind of says, well, you know, that's for you to decide. But ultimately, he's building a case for there's not much hope in the local church. Therefore, let's glom on not to the little C church, but the big C church, and let's jump outside and you know, try to raise the banner there. And I embrace his passion to want to change the world. I personally have just come to the conclusion that I can't. But Jesus can. And somewhere in that, he is going to engage me in what he's doing. And I felt like the importance of defining that reality and getting that clear is huge. Because in as much as I'm still marching according to a drivenness that this is a mandate that I must do and it's my job, I do think you end up with the pressures of performance that some have interpreted a little bit within this, that it's more like when I recognize what God is up to and I'm just going to find my place within that and He remains in charge and I simply remain an obedient part, mm-hmm. things are balanced a whole lot better for me. Yeah. At this present understanding.
Well, Barnard does not present himself as a prophet or a seer. So what you have in this book is not somebody saying, man, I'm looking into God's heart and I see that this is what He's doing in the world. This is a statistician who's talking to a lot of people and gathering data and saying, from this data, we're noticing a very interesting trend. I can predict a trend that's already happening and then project as to where that may end up. So I don't think people are going to read this and saying, oh, we're going to get real hard on what God's doing, because I don't think that's his perspective, really.
No.
He makes some conclusions about that. Some I thought were fairly valid. Some I was less excited about. I would love to talk to him personally. Someone wrote me this week and said, if you guys get Barna for a podcast, would you be interested? And we said, absolutely. We would love to pick his brain and do that. And he's got some kind of backdoor way to get us in to do that. So if that happens, we'd love to bring that to you. But not sure whether it will, to be honest. It's not a large media venue to ply your wares, I guess. But maybe he'll have some interest. He's only down the road from us. He's not far away. So
I'm excited about the fact that as a researcher or statistician, he is able to look at this and go, you know what? He recognized an entrenched mentality that is going to fight against this. And he does a good job, I think, of sort of outlawing that and just sort of saying, you know, this is the nature of where we're at. This is kind of its historical dimensions of it's kind of always been like this to some degree. But he is acknowledging the fact that there's something huge that is taking place. It is widespread. And it is quantifiable, identifiable, and it's probably unstoppable. You know, and it's like this is having a major impact on the world and, you know, hopefully the outworking of the culture. Because that's at least where he saw the thrust of this taking it, as opposed to a bunch of people being trying to be brought into a system that is being reformed. He's going like, bottom line, this thing is shaking up that whole system and tossing those people out like salt and light, which is, I think, a great thing.
I think it's a great thing. It doesn't project where that's going to end up. He says, we don't know what it's going to look like 20 years from now. Will those people regather in various ways and find ways to share this life together? And that's an unknown. Obviously, it's an unknown. What I think I appreciate that this book will have an impact on, because you and I have talked about this for the last 3 or 4 years. If people who are hearing from God would just have the courage to trust what God's putting on their heart and do what He's asking them to do, things would be incredible. I mean, the things God would do would be incredible. But we've got this illusion of, we always use the Wizard of Oz analogy. You know, you've got this wizard that everybody's supposed to follow and do. And that's not a specific pastor, but it's the whole clergy mentality. There's somebody
the
up there.
The guy behind the veil working the machine.
Well, the idea is what the wizard is. No, there's something there that we really are not bright enough, and so we need to listen and follow and do, because, my goodness, how am I going to know what God wants to do? But we've always talked about, once you've been the guy behind that wizard, once you've pulled the machine and you realize the illusion you create, for you and I to walk away from those things and say, hey, there was some good stuff there, but there was a lot of other stuff that we just didn't want to put up with anymore. I think very different for us who've been behind the scenes than people who never have. And they see the illusion, and I think what this book does is it really helps people have the insight, have somebody outside validate the fact that there is a living experience with Jesus Christ that many people are experiencing, and real relational community with other brothers and sisters outside of the Sunday morning clubs that we're all told we had to be in to count. And I think if that helps people say, well, then, God, I am going to do what you're asking me to do. I have felt like I didn't need to keep going there, and I there's some other people I could call. We'd get together and have some times on this journey. And that's been on my heart for a long time, but I've never had the courage to do it. If this helps do that, I think that'd be great.
Well, I think that's one of the objectives that he set out in the forward, in the beginning, is he is really wanting to validate that reality. And I think that's very important, because you know, I think for so long as someone who was sort of one of the prime promoters in church, you know, cheerleaders of what was going on, when you encountered someone that was dissatisfied, that was always such a challenge, a conundrum. It's like, well, you know, if I was honest, well, so am I.
Right.
You know? But in as much as this is what I've got to do, then I got to make sure that that person is just not being critical and that they're spreading their stuff that's not going to help our cause anyways. I think what it does is it validates the reality that there's a God-given source of dissatisfaction that is prevalent.
Yes.
And widespread.
Yes.
And that isn't because you're just bitter or critical or you're rebellious. It's
right.
Because you've actually tasted something real, and that isn't always what we're being fed.
Yeah, that taste for reality somehow can't always be satisfied, or even close to being satisfied,
yeah,
in some of those congregational things. Now, we do hear often from people, somebody wrote me earlier this week and said, I don't understand what you guys are talking about the institution. I've been part of this thing for 3 or 4 years, and I'm finding great life with God. And there are some wonderful groups of people in there meeting under things called churches who really do get a lot of this journey right. I mean, they're living, encouraging people to love God. They've not, you know, they've got this machine going. They're not doing a lot of those things. There are places like that, and I think I want to underscore that. At the same time, we want to say there are people that are saying, it doesn't work for me anymore. My hunger's doesn't fit into my experience of that, so I want to begin to look elsewhere for what God does. And I think to recognize that they are not alone, that there's a significant number of people around the world who are spontaneously and simultaneously finding a way to live in God with greater depth and finding conversations like this with brothers and sisters on the journey, that is far better than figuring out, do we need more parking places in the parking lot and need a bigger building, what kind of carpet we need here. But people are just saying, what does it mean for me to know Him in truth and to live in that reality? And I like what this talks about too, that there's not a less engagement of the culture with this. It's not trying to withdraw from the culture so we have less influence. He actually says, statistically, traditional churches are having no influence on the culture. In fact, most of the influence from that they can measure statistically among the world is negative. People aren't embracing the message that institutional Christianity brings today. So he's saying that the chance to be more influential in the world is to be outside looking for alternative ways to touch the world and to love your neighbor and to do the things Jesus asked us to do.
Yeah, and I think he does it, at least I resonated with an excitement of a picture that he was sort of painting, you know, kind of saying the trends are leading to this. He's really looking at the unleashing of the church, that it's no longer contained within the four walls. I mean, I think I mentioned this in a podcast long ago, but I remember in the middle of a service talking about, you know, the nature of the church and how, you know, Jesus says, I've come to build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And I didn't have this in my notes and I hadn't thought this before in my head, but I all of a sudden it popped in my head and it's like the Lord made me to understand, Brad, what are the walls, you know, what are the gates of hell? And I had everyone stand up as this is being downloaded in the midst of what I'm saying. And I said, look, right now the gates of hell are the four walls in which we are contained. The mindset that keeps us cloistered in a place of irrelevance. If we think this is church, then the gates of hell have prevailed. Because we are over in this
we're
little
here,
arena,
not there. Yeah.
And we're not seasoning the culture like salt, or, you know, it's like our light is under this little bushel, and that was a profound, that was a watershed moment of having my understanding shift, and I began to realize, you know what, He has called us to be in a much more real, dynamic, engaged place with the world around us. You know, we're to be in the world, but not of it.
Right.
And it's like most of the time we're not in the world, we're in our gatherings. And the energy is spent trying to make that happen. And what he is recognizing is that is having a fruitless outcome. All the energy, money, and effort is being spent there, and it's not producing a change upon the culture.
Brad, we got a letter here from Gene talking about this book a bit. So I'm writing in response to your invitation to comment on Barna's Revolution. I first heard of it on your podcast in the context of your being interviewed for Time Magazine. Whatever happened to that? I don't know. Time Magazine hasn't done the article, and I don't know if they're going to, if they just put it off, or if they've just moved on with other things. But anyway, she said, I was excited about the book. While it is not perfect and incomplete in many areas, it has the potential to shake up the box while other writers on the same topic would be ignored, seen as a threat, or labeled as heretics. It's a real eye-opener for the church establishment. It's not that he has anything new to say. There are many books out there, and he is mainly interpreting research. The real value here is that it is Barna, the widely respected and quoted authority on what's going on in the church. So there's a good chance this book will be noticed. I don't think there's any doubt it will be noticed. And so I can see where you are concerned with the emphasis on being rather than doing. And that was one of the things I blogged about, that there's so much in this book that defines revolutionaries by what they're doing.
Right.
And we've really said, boy, the heart of this thing is people are catching and coming alive in Christ. Some of the doing in this book seems to be demographically more toward younger audiences that are looking for a different church experience than they had. But I know I'm dealing with a lot of people in their 50s and 60s who were leaders in traditional institutions who are not on this side of it because they were looking for something different, but because God connected with them in such a way. And he does talk a little bit about this relationship with God that people are hungering for, but I wish he'd got into that more.
It's
in depth.
Hard to put statistics on that.
Yeah, you can't.
It's hard to quantify it. Like, it is easier to, you know, a bunch of different actions. I mean, there's a comment, George commenting.
He's
on
from
George.
Pennsylvania, by the way. George on George.
He just finished reading the book. What stuck out to me was how he continually mentions things we must do in order to be considered good Christians and not backsliders. This book will help those who are looking for permission to do it. So while he gives those seeking permission, to me he is still hung up in fruit inspecting to make sure that we're on the right path. He's still stuck in the mindset of what we must do in order to please or be pleasing to the Father. No thanks, I tried that for 30 years and got nothing but tired and burnt out. You'll like this, Wayne. He said, it's an okay book, but Barna sure ain't no Jacobson.
there you go. And I bet Barna's grateful for that.
So here you got a big fan. I mean, in all fairness, I don't know that he's saying, you know, you need to do this to be a good Christian. I think what he's wanting to do is, I think his efforts seem to be fanning the flame and saying he wants to see this revolution happen. I really believe
I believe
he's excited about what's going on. He's trying to validate it, and he's trying to motivate and inspire others to say, like, look, here are the seven passions, commit yourself to that. Here are the marks, commit yourself to that. Here are
the confessions or affirmations of a revolutionary.
And here are the mini movements, the seven mini movements that, I mean, everything's the perfect number seven. It's great for quantifying stuff, but I think when I read it all, I sat there, you know, it's not seven passions for me. It's one simple reality. It is, I've been brought back to a place where I began as a little guy, the simple friendship with Jesus.
With the living God. Absolutely.
And as I am inspired by Him, it was interesting, as I began to read the book, just prior to it, Jonathan came up to me with his little laser gun. And it has this little red laser, and Jared's laser worked, but Jonathan's didn't. And so this was a big issue,
because
we couldn't play war because your laser's not working. And, you know, the funny thing is, this is for Chipper fans. This is how they bring Chipper in the house. When he's out at night trying to catch flies and different stuff, I mean, he has a lot of fun.
Catches flies? Is this a frog or a cat?
No. This is a cat that's on a hunt. I mean, this guy loves being outside. One of the things they do is they take one of these little laser lights and they put it on the ground.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty soon Chipper sees it, and then just slowly lead him in the house. It's hilarious to watch, right? So we need to fix the Chipper gun. And, you know, I checked the batteries. I checked everything. I finally had to take this whole thing apart. And I realized right at the trigger, there was a single loose wire. Everything else was fine. But I had to resolder this one single loose wire that was right where the trigger connects the circuit. And it was fun, because I was going, like, well, why am I doing this? Why am I spending so much? I did it, and as I read this book and as I finally put it down, I realized, you know what? My critique, there's so much in here that I genuinely love and agree with, but there is a point at which I'm trying to get the laser to turn on that at times this book, it doesn't turn on that laser for me. And it's when in his crosshairs, he's focused on the revolution, or the revolutionary, as opposed to Jesus,
yep,
that there's a disconnect for me and the light doesn't come on.
Yep.
It's as you stop to try to take the pulse of what's going on, which is not wrong to do. I just found at that moment my passion and agreement with what was going on lagged. And I just kind of went, no, that's not it for me.
I think that's what George from Pennsylvania is getting to. I, in looking at what it means to participate in what God's doing today, I think people who are excited about that are really excited about Jesus.
Yeah.
They're not excited about being a revolutionary. They haven't got these seven passions of this, that, or the other thing.
And then these seven mini movements that did this to them.
Not the affirmations. I think what the core of it is, it's all about Jesus. It really is. Follow Him. Cultivate this relationship with Him. Live in Him. Do what He puts on your heart to do. Don't worry about how other people are judging. And I actually think part of this whole thing that God's doing to even move people outside, part of, I think, what has needed to be challenged in us is the rejection that we have faced from people who don't understand what we're doing. I kind of worry about, boy, if we make it palatable to be outside the box again, then people are going to be there for other reasons than God's asked me to be here. And I'm doing it even if people don't understand and even if I'm not getting the approval of people. I think that is an important part of this journey. And this book could cut that short.
That was one thing I wrote in the margin as he was sort of defining and talking about the seven passions and all this other stuff. I sat there and I realized you could find someone who's dissatisfied with where they're at. You can make this revolution sound so exciting that they choose to sign up with this new thing.
Right.
Without having undergone a revolution.
Yeah. Because now it's seven things to do.
Yeah, it's like I can re-jump on the same bandwagon of a different sort. And I think that's an unintentional reality.
Oh, I agree.
With the way some of this is packaged. And it's like, look, I understand how books are written and you're wanting to somehow take a huge thing that you can't get your arms around and make it into something that you can. I just think that, you know what, it is bigger than that. And the great thing is, it is bigger than that. It's bigger than this.
And when anything becomes a substitute for our naked surrender and obedience to Christ and desire to know Him and live in Him and follow Him, if it's to do a revolution, if it's the seven passions of this, if our focus is anywhere but, Jesus, who are you in my life today? And how do you want me to follow you? We're going to miss it.
Yeah, you're going to end up in the same place.
This becomes just another movement men have created instead of just, you know what? And I think most people that I get with and on this journey these days that I'm talking to, I don't think this will change that for them. I think they really understand this is about Jesus, always has been. That's who I want to know. That's who I want to live in. That's whose reflection I want to be in the world. You just can imagine there'll be in 10 years a denomination called Revolution that'll claim to be part of, because that's how we've always done it for 2,000 years. He does say in the course of this, I think this is probably a good place to kind of jump off of it. He says, existing churches will have a historic decision to make, to ignore the revolution and continue business as usual, or to invest energy in fighting the revolution as an unbiblical advance, or to look for ways of retaining their identity while cooperating with the revolution as a mark of unity and genuine ministry. My current research suggests the latter approach will be the least common. I didn't even like his latter approach. How we're going to retain our identity and we're going to cooperate with the revolution is still a big part of the problem.
yes, it is.
So even if they're doing what he thinks is positive, I like better. Toward the end of this book, he gives two reactions in sharing some of this material with current
friends
of his who are pastors. And it was interesting the response. One, which I absolutely love, this is a pastor, and he's noticed that some of his families are no longer coming as consistently, but that they've gone on to continue in Christ well. And he says, at the end of it, he says, if he's heard all about this, he says, so I realize that these revolutionaries, as you call them, are not likely to return to our building, and that there are many others like them who are getting active spiritually but will never set foot in our church. But it shouldn't really matter, he continued quietly. As a pastor, I've always wanted to help people become passionate, active believers. So it would be kind of hypocritical of me to get upset that people were becoming genuine disciples without my influence or outside of our church. God's kingdom isn't about who gets credit. I should be as excited as you that these people are walking the walk. You know how frustrated I get over the legions in our churches that only talk the talk but ignore the walk. So you can see he wants to respond rightly,
yeah,
but it's a challenge. Because it does.
Well, it threatens his livelihood, everything that he's put a stake in terms of what they're building and identifying and
absolutely.
Where they get their, all those things. I think that's the biggest challenge is, you know what, it's not that there's anything wrong with being involved in a community or some local church or invested organization. The challenge is if that gets in the way of you finding your identity, value, purpose, everything else smack dab in God as someone who's loved by Him. I mean, even the idea of, I'm going to be a revolutionary, that's not my identity.
Oh, absolutely not.
What fans my fires, I'm profoundly loved.
Yep.
And that gets me up in the morning and I go like, wow, that makes me feel like, yeah, there's a revolution going on, no doubt. And I've experienced Him, not an it.
Yep.
And I think that's where I always get frustrated. Whenever we make this an it,
yep.
If your church is an it, and it's not Him.
Whether it's in a house, in a tree, in a park, in a building. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think this guy's kind of... churches?
Yeah, there you go. I think this guy's kind of rare. If that's how most of these guys respond, I think that'd be
incredible.
Maybe
we have more of those.
He quotes another guy, though, and I think this is probably a little more typical of people who feel that sense of threat. He explains to them the whole thing, and then... they have this 90-minute discussion. Here's the end of it he gives us. He says, so you see, George, God has no plan B. The local church is God's plan A, His chosen vehicle. And He does not need any other plan. Anything outside of that means is simply indefensible from a biblical standpoint. Never second-guess God, my friend. Follow Him and accept His paths. No church has ever been perfect, but there's no reason to abandon it. Remaking the church into the form you desire rather than the form God ordained is simply not legitimate. Let God be God. Help the local church be more effective, but don't ever, ever take any steps to replace it.
I've had lunch with that guy. He's a body snatcher. He takes the form of many different people.
I can't get those guys to go to lunch with me, but obviously you feel his angst.
Well, no, I mean, I think the reality is there is something that is happening that is, quote, you know, letting the sheep out of the sheep pen. And for those who feel it's their job to somehow protect and save the sheep from the reality of being a sheep, they got to keep them in the pen.
Exactly.
But I'm thrilled with the fact that there is a move of real freedom, I think, that comes from the Father that you're just not going to stop. And if you try to get in the way of it, you know, what a futile effort. And why, at the end of the day, I mean, you will be confronted with, at the end of the day, this is about me losing what I think I had, as opposed to me serving and what the Father is doing.
But when you think what you have is what the Father is the responsibilities Father has given you to protect it. That's what I hear in that language.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the only way. It's kind of like those articles in Christianity Day and Charisma that we kind of explored last spring. Yes, it's dying, but we must all be here and die together. It was like, you kind of hear that same sentiment. This is all
we've
got. I want
to be part of Custer's crowd.
And to think there is nothing. When you read the life of Jesus in the Gospels, and you read through the epistles of the early church, you don't catch anything. You don't catch anything about how you gather, what routine you have to do. Nothing is there because this wasn't for them about a routine, a tradition.
No.
This was about living deeply in Christ and sharing that life with other brothers and sisters you find on the journey, and certainly being a reflection of His in the world so that others can come to know who He is. You don't need buildings for that. You don't need these structures for that. If they serve you, fine. But there's a lot of folks that it's not serving. I love what Kevin, our friend from Australia, our Australian correspondent says over, and he described it this way: Jesus is just taking His church back. And I just love how simple that is. Just people who will be His, who will follow the Lamb wherever He goes. My sheep will know My voice. They'll follow Me. A stranger they will not follow. And I think what's happening now is more and more people are learning the difference between the voice of Jesus and the voice of strangers. And they're just not wanting to follow strangers anymore. And that's going to take a few of them strangers off, probably.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a lot of well-intentioned friends that are still in ministry. And I mean, these are people I respect. I like what comes out of their lives. But, you know, for some of them, I know their whole life is invested in the structure and the system that they are busy building. And they're sincerely building it for God. I mean,
In their mind.
I mean, right. I do think that, you know, I'm not going to question the sincerity of what they believe they're doing. But they just have a conniption fit when someone is not doing that deal. And it always has sort of veiled, subtle fear warnings of, well, you know what, that's just dangerous, and, you know, this is where God is. And it's because so much of the way we have understood church down through time, for most people, and I think you said it again, it has become synonymous with that's that local identified thing that meets in that building over there on Sunday. And if you're not part of that, then, oh, we question, are you really part of Christ? That's like, the nice thing that I think George Barna does is he turns that completely on its ear, gives some great biblical foundations for the reality of and the validity of doing that, and just sort of re-questions some of people's basic, you know, foundations and fundamental assertions.
And hopefully that will be very, very helpful to a lot of folks and to the kingdom. We may want to cover this more. If some of you have some questions, comments, you know how to get in touch with us. Follow through on that. And we'll explore us a little more if we need to. But otherwise, I'm pretty well done with it. How about you, Brad?
On with the revolution.
What? Put that flag down.
Thanks for traveling with us today on The God Journey. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd appreciate your questions or feedback by email or at our blog at thegodjourney.com. Or you can call 24 hours a day to our comment line at 805-626-4212.